Welcome to the MRI Cast. These podcasts focus on various current topics in MRI. We invite you to ask questions via their website and even suggest topics for future MRI casts. The opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect standards in clinical practices, nor should they be considered as medical advice. This program is made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics. All right, everyone. Welcome again to the MRI Cast. This is episode number 2. I want to remind you that these podcasts are made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics, and we certainly do appreciate that. Don't forget to, if you haven't already, visit the main website. You can sign up there to subscribe to these podcasts. You can also ask questions regarding any podcast and even suggest topics. So please visit that site and take advantage of the opportunity to make comments. If you like what you're hearing, my name is Bill. If you don't like it, my name is Howard. And so you can just...
Okay, Mr. Wise Guy.
Well, actually, though, I should be honest. My middle name is Howard anyway, so it's, either way it goes, I guess. Anyway, so today's episode, again, with me is Kristen Harrington and Dr. Howard Raleigh. So welcome again, guys. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
All right. My pleasure. Okay, so what we're going to talk about today is... breast MRI, and in specifically focusing on something that has come to the forefront in the last several years. I think it was, if I remember correctly from reading some articles, first proposed by a Dr. Christiana Kuhl, K-U-H-L, I believe. And she first proposed that in some publications back around 2014.
Yeah, she's been doing it. She's been doing this overseas. She's from Germany, and she's been doing this protocol for many years now. So it's just becoming something that's a lot more accepted and being adopted here in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hearing more and more about it. Howard, do y'all have anything in place there at the U?
We do. And, you know, I think part of what's driving this direction toward more breast MR is the recognition that something like half of women have dense breasts, and so the traditional workhorse mammographic evaluation is limited in its sensitivity for detection of cancers. So both routine protocols and now abbreviated protocols seem to have an important place, and even states are legislating that women be informed if they have dense breasts, that they need to be aware of the limitations of mammography and aware of potentially other methods like MR.
Well, what about just either of you have any recent statistics, if you will, about breast cancer in general, in the general population?
I do. I just looked some things up. The most recent data out there, I think a lot of people don't know that it is the highest death rate next to lung cancer, and approximately 1 in 8 women will develop it over, you know, the course of their lifetime. Last year, it was estimated that over 40,000 women died from breast cancer. Another thing that people don't know is that if you're under the age of 45, it's a lot higher prevalence in African American women. And so, the other thing that is really interesting is that 85% diagnosed have no family history. And I find that to be fascinating. And this is just from the breast cancer organization, this information that I have. But, you know, and Howard, you can chime in here, but one thing that's really changed is that we have decreased the number of diagnosed breast cancers since around the year 2000, because of, well, they're leaning toward and saying, and you can elaborate on this, not using the hormone replacement therapy.
Well, just extrapolating from what you said, first of all, on the statistics, this is an enormous problem when you move it to population level. So this year, it's been estimated in the U.S. alone there'll be about 276,000 new breast cancers, invasive breast cancers, in addition to nearly 50,000 new cases of non-invasive breast cancer in situ. So an enormous problem, and how to diagnose this early issue, because whether people are on hormone replacement or not, earlier diagnosis has been associated with greater survival, because of course it's intuitive that you get things at an earlier stage before they're metastatic locally or it's systemically. And so it's a real challenge and a real common problem that we obviously need better ways to deal with.
I think that one thing that you said, in situ, I'm not sure if everyone even knows what that means. Do you want to explain in situ?
Right. There's a category of a breast cancer called ductal carcinoma in situ, so DCIS. And it's controversial about how to manage that. Some of that may never grow, but some of it is actually highly risky and highly malignant. And I think most people would rather err on the side of detecting both the invasive cancers as well as the DCIS so that you have a chance to look at your options and decide, do we need to biopsy this? If we biopsy it, what does it mean? It's, I think, the most important topic here, though, it would be finding the invasive cancers. There's no argument about that.
You know, one of the things that, before we get into the MR part, there was one other thing that I'm reading through some of the material, and I thought some of the people listening may not be familiar with that. And Howard, correct me, and Kristen, correct me if I'm wrong here, but so there are these categories called BI-RADS. I'm sure it's short for something, and is that like a classification of a type of tumor?
Yes. BI-RAD stands for Breast Imaging Reporting and Data Systems, and they're actually in multiple organs now, LI-RADS for liver, et cetera. There are these categories that give us a way to shorthand estimate how risky a discovered lesion is. And in the case of BI-RADS, it's a scale from 0 to 6. The key ones are 1 to 5, where at the lower end, for instance, BI-RADS 1 would be a breast lesion that is not suspicious, essentially zero chance of cancer. And at the other end of the spectrum, a BI-RADS 5 would be highly suggestive of malignancy. And in between, you have BI-RADS 2, which is benign looking. 3 is probably benign. 4 is suspicious. And then at the 0, there's no risk. And at 6, it's a proven malignancy from biopsy. So this not only gives us a way to sort of categorize things, but also leads to follow-up recommendations or even biopsy recommendations in the case of the more suspicious lesions.
You know, one thing that I find interesting about what you're saying is I saw a paper, and I presented on it as well, but it was about using a higher field strength, and that's relative, but looking between 1.5 Tesla and 3 Tesla in the BI-RADS classification and using the higher field strength in certain patients, they were classifying between 2 and 3, and 1 means no necessary, you know, immediate follow-up. Where when you get to BI-RADS 3, and correct if I'm wrong, I think that's where you have to have a short-term interval follow-up. But by using a higher field strength, it was able to classify it. It changed it from BI-RADS 2 to BI-RADS 3, which is a pretty big difference because you do have a follow-up. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, not specifically. I'm aware of that work. We use 1.5 or 3T interchangeably. We have a fleet of multiple magnets. And I think probably some of the advantage that you might see in some of the 3T papers is that they're more modern magnets, maybe with better coils or tables and better software. That, to me, is more important, at least in our practice, than the field strength.
You know, it's interesting how things have changed over time. I went back and I looked at, some of the stuff that primarily Kristen put together that we've had in some of our courses. And there was a paper, and at the start of one of the presentations, it references a paper that was published in 1991, which was one of the first papers, I think, about it actually compared, the title was MR Imaging of Breast with Gadolinium DTPA Enhancement, Comparison with Mammography and Ultrasound. So basically, it was just saying, yes, you could do it. The reality was they concluded that even though MR, and this was in 91, though, can add important information, the results of mammography and ultrasound are insufficient, you know, can add information when mammography and ultrasound are insufficient. But quite honestly, the paper said that the results of ultrasound were highly similar to those of MR imaging. Of course, that's not what we see today. I mean, it basically is saying you can do it. And I remember in the early days of breast MR, the big key point was everything that all cancers enhance, but not everything that it enhances is a cancer. And would you all agree that what's happened over this time period is primarily technical improvements? Again, field strength, certainly, but coils and the advent of techniques such as dynamic imaging, things like that, that's really what's improved the performance of breast MRI. Would you all agree?
I started at Emory doing breast imaging back in, I want to say, 1996, we were using linear coils. And obviously now we know we're using multi-channel. And there's a significant difference based upon the coil development. The other issue that we ran into was we were not able to get the dynamics. And that's what I call the money scan, is doing the dynamic contrast enhanced. We were not able to get our dynamics short enough to be able to catch the lesions and look at the values as far as the uptake. We were not able to get the sequences short enough for each dynamic.
I think one of the other major advances that's really helped is the uniformity, spectral uniformity, so that we can get much better fat saturation with some of the modern software and hardware than we used to get. And so for our, you know, axial T2 fat sats, things like, I'm a GE shop, we use Aspir, A-S-P-I-R, and it's bulletproof. It just really works nicely to give us uniform fat sat, and that makes a huge difference and takes less time because you don't have to manually shim and scan and try to adjust things.
Is that more like one, like an adiabatic type fat saturation
sequence? It's similar to like spectral adiabatic and version recovery is what it's called on other systems. Mm-hmm. Is it something like that?
Yes. It's a newer option.
And you on that note, I asked Dr. Bonnie Lee when I was at Grand Rounds, when I was on faculty at Emory, I asked, and I said, why don't you use, she was an advocate, if you didn't have good fat saturation, then to go ahead and do the dynamic without fat saturation and then to do subtraction afterwards. And I asked her at the end, and this is, you know, several years ago, I said, you know, why don't you go ahead and use a spare technique. And she said that there was a loss in spatial resolution or there was a trade-off. Do you have that with Aspir?
No, those are still quite good. They're a little bit longer than a routine T2. They're 3 or 4 minutes, but still quite acceptable, even in a fast protocol.
You know, I think sometimes when you hear people say, like to Kristen's point, when they say, well, when I use this, there's a loss in spatial resolution. Well, that's a function of voxel volume. So likely what happens is when I hear people say that, likely what happens is because of whatever technique they're using, their scan time increases. And so then to get the time back down, they typically give up spatial resolution. You know, it's got to be some limitation.
Yeah, she had to keep it within a certain time frame. So therefore, she was giving up the spatial resolution in order to do so. And that was with the spare technique. And so that's why she chose, you know, if she didn't have uniform pre on the T2 fat sat, then she would do the dynamic contrast enhance without and then do subtraction, which is also something that is a lot of people do not like to do in the U.S. And as we start talking about the abbreviated protocol, I think it's going to be a lot more accepted. But it's something that's highly adopted, doing a subtractive technique in Europe.
I remember some of the first papers I saw coming out of Europe, they were almost always subtracted as opposed to fat saturation. One of the problems, and it, I think, now I know it was, I'm pretty sure it was, Howard, it was you that I heard say this in some of the conferences and stuff that we've done together in the past, is that if you have, if it wasn't you, I'm giving you credit for it.
Thank you.
If no problem. And so it's, if it was saying basically, if you don't have good fat saturation, then if you throw subtraction on top of that, that really just only exacerbates the problem. It's and in fact, I seem to remember you quoting Billy Preston saying, "Nothing from nothing leaves nothing."
That's true.
And yeah, and so was that? Yeah, I mean that's the thing. I think subtraction can be well utilized. You know, can work really well if people will do it. Of course, you have to have the patient hold very still. But be that as it may, if you've got really bad fat suppression, you know, and this is for the dynamic sequence that you're going to do, that's real problematic. And I mean, I want your opinion on this. I know Kristen and I have talked about it. Our recommendation or our opinion is if it's not going to work, turn it off and then just subtract.
Right. And in our longer sort of traditional protocol, we use a dynamic T1 vibrant. We use three phases. There's a 2.5 minute mask and then three phases. So it's the longest part of the exam. That part alone in our long exam is 11 minutes. And then we take the first phase and make routine sagittal and coronal reformats from the axial data set. And then we do get subtractions and MIP rotates on those scans. We like the vibrant, seems to give us good fat saturation. It's a high definition fat suppressed breast imaging sequence. So it's key again to getting the technical parts right to, so that all of your reconstructions work well.
And that's a certain package that a lot of people may not have. I think that, you know, keeping that in mind, one thing, you know, Bill was saying is that these patients do move. And I think that's one thing that's very difficult. It's not, I don't know if either one of you have laid on a breast coil, but it's not comfortable. And with these standard protocols that last approximately 45 minutes, at minimum 30, typically 45, they do get uncomfortable. They do start to move. And I think that's another thing that's fantastic, that we're starting to see this adoption of the abbreviated breast screening, you know, sequences and protocols that we're doing.
Well, I've always thought for the longest that, you know, in talking with sites and talking to them about optimizing their protocols, is that if you've got a breast protocol that lasts 45 minutes, and what happens is the dynamic sequence, which I'd like to know what Howard thinks about this following statement, the dynamic sequence, as you said, is the most important sequence. That's where a lot of the information comes from. That gets put toward the end. And so by the time you get to the dynamic sequence, if you're spending all this time on all these other sequences, which I'm not saying they're not you know, worthwhile. I'm just saying that it can run this out. I know a lot of people have always said how long their breast exams are, and it's not comfortable for the patient. It puts the dynamic toward the end of it. Quite honestly, I think it increases the likelihood. I mean, your patient's anxious anyway. They're very anxious, and rightly so. And you know, you put that toward the end. They're anxious toward the end. I think it increases the likelihood that they're going to get nauseated when you inject contrast and saline in them. And I just think it's very problematic if the sequence, you know, if your whole protocol is very, very long. I mean, what do you think, Howard?
Well, that's one reason why we've, for example, moved our diffusion weighted sequence in the breast protocol to post contrast. We feel it's probably one, if we were going to give one up or they're not doing well, we're willing to give that up, and we don't even run it if they have implants, for example. So I think looking at the order of the sequences, just as you carefully do for other protocols like the brain protocols, where you may throw in a T2 flare as your first post contrast as a little time spacer. But you're right, the dynamic or the early phase is key. And the other thing we haven't mentioned yet, but one of the advances actually brought out by Dr. Kuhl again, was to show that the contrast itself makes a difference, that the higher relaxivity of gadobenate or multihance in a head-to-head comparison with a traditional relaxivity agent detected nearly 12% more cancers. And so when we get to this abbreviated protocol we're going to talk about today, that's the agent they used, and it may be part of the reason it was so successful.
Yeah, so let's actually just go ahead and move toward that. I'm sure, you know, we can discuss. There's really, I don't think, any need to discuss what an exceptionally long protocol is. That just includes every sequence you can think of, you know, to throw in there. So from a standard protocol, I know, Kristen, you looked at the literature, and Howard, you obviously looked at it as well. So what is an abbreviated breast protocol? I know it may vary, and let's see between y'all what varies. What is an abbreviated breast protocol?
Well, from what I, you know, see and hear from people across the U.S., you know, obviously it's going to have a localizer. The total scan time's between 10 and 12, maybe 15 minutes at most. And I've seen T2 stirs or T2 weighted sequences, quick T2s, and then a T1 pre with FatSat. Then again, what I call the money scan, the dynamic contrast enhanced. And I think that Howard made a great point about the type of agent that you used as far as the relaxivity. And then just a T1 FatSat post, and then they're done.
The paper that we keep obliquely referring to, we should probably explicitly say what it is. It's in JAMA from February 25th, 2020. Lead author is Christopher Comstock from Memorial Sloan Kettering, and the senior author is Christiana Kuhl from Aachen, Germany. And in that study, they compared an abbreviated protocol versus digital breast tomosynthesis. And if you download the supplement from that paper, they go through the details of their MR protocol. It's supplement 1, page 38. And what they did was basically just T2s and then axial T1 GREs at less than or equal to 3 millimeters slice thickness, pre and post a single dose, 0.1 millimole per kilo of multihance. So they only had 3 sequences, and their average time was 8 minutes for the entire protocol. So that was moving pretty fast.
So in the dynamic, so in the basically it's a T1 spoiled gradient echo run as fairly rapidly as they can. Do you have any idea of like how long each particular dynamic phase was and how many phases they did?
No, it looked like from what I could glean, and I haven't talked to the investigators, it looked like they were just doing a pre and post axial GRE, something like an SPGR. And so they did this at 48 centers around the world. 47 of those centers had never done an abbreviated protocol. And they were all able to successfully do this. And it was a large study, over 1,400 patients who got both digital breast tomosynthesis and MRI at baseline and then 1 year follow-up.
So basically, they really weren't necessarily doing multi-phase dynamic. They're just doing a pre and a post.
That's what it looks
like. So I'm assuming, okay, so then fairly high resolution. The two ways to look at this, some people will do, you know, moderate, for lack of a better word, moderate resolution, 3 millimeter slice thicknesses, you know, try to get, you know, as high, small pixel resolution as you possibly can.
Yes, they required in-plane resolution less than a millimeter or equal to a millimeter. So they were 3 millimeter slices, which allowed them to go pretty fast, but the in-plane was quite good.
And so that's, you know, I mean, they kept it kind of fast, but so what a lot of people do, I know at some of the centers I'm familiar with here in the area, the dynamic phases are about 90 seconds, give or take. And so you know, do one pre and then you inject and then you do several, you know, three, maybe four phases. What do y'all do there at your place, Howard?
Well, for our traditional protocol, we do three phases after the mask, and they're about 2.5 minutes each. So that's relatively long, but these are very high resolution studies.
And you do this bilateral axial, which is another thing, by the way, that's changed over the years. You know, we weren't able to do this. Now I think everybody's moving primarily to bilateral axial, you know, an axial.
All of our scans are axials, yep, with reformats.
Yeah, in this study, I'm just looking at an abstract here. The digital breast tomosynthesis, I can't say it, DBT, detected 7 out of 17 with invasive cancers and 2 out of 6, whereas the abbreviated breast MRI, if I'm not mistaken, detected them all, correct?
That's
yes.
Right. The abbreviated breast MRI detected all the invasive cancers and also detected in terms of the DCIS, these smaller in situ in the place cancers, it detected all but one of them. And this is with follow-up, so they, you know, at least 1 year follow-up. So it was much, much more sensitive than the digital breast tomosynthesis.
In what patient population, or is there necessarily a patient population? I mean, if you read Christiana Kuhl's articles and you go by, you know, her viewpoint, she thinks you can pretty much do everyone in an abbreviated breast protocol, right? I mean, do I take what I read her saying? Well, I mean, she almost believes this is all you need to do. This will cover all your bases.
She feels pretty strongly that it should be one of the first things that you go to when you're looking for breast cancer, and then using the abbreviated protocol is she feels very strongly about using that abbreviated because of the sensitivity. And so, yeah, definitely, if you look at many of the articles that she's written, that's what she states very clearly. I think the movement here in the U.S. has been highly focused on, we need a way to address people that are at intermediate risk, that can't get insurance approval, and they can't afford to have it. And so that's, I believe, where this abbreviated really started evolving in the U.S. because it allowed people that had highly dense tissue, that had a family history that was too far removed for them to be considered at higher risk. And it opened up an area where they could pay a lot less money and have access to having an MR. And doing this abbreviated study made it possible. Now, Howard, I don't know about how you feel about that, how you handle that at your facility, but that's what I've seen across the U.S. and talking to different people that are adopting. Initially, they adopted this as something to allow this to be something for people that don't have access to it, and using the abbreviated for that, you know, class of people. But now it seems to be a little bit more being adopted as a standardized protocol at many places.
Yeah, I think you've made a number of good points. I think we do need to step back for a second and look at, you know, like with any screening technique in a large population, you have to have a sort of a prior probability. In other words, the odds of disease detection. So your screening tool has to be good. And it may be, you know, that our workhorse mammography is, I think, is arguably still very good for women who have less dense breasts, so more fat, so you can see the dense tumors in a standard mammogram. I think the place for MR is especially, besides all the problem solving and, you know, pre-op and post-op and so forth, in the screening regime, I think it has a great place for the women with more fibrous, dense material that would hide the cancers. So I see this as a tool for women with breast, with dense breasts. That's about half the population. So it's a huge population, but there are a group of patients with low risk and fatty breasts who can probably just go with standard mammography screening.
I know a friend of mine was telling me about an issue with or a scenario with his wife here recently, if I remember it correctly. So you go for a screening mammogram, and so the screening mammogram's done, and then it's reviewed, and then, you know, she gets a call like, we're going to need you to come back for some additional views, and that, of course, just really now you know, and by the way, it'll be a few days, you know, and so now this is, you know, just going to weigh, you know, you automatically assume the worst. And, you know, it turns out, you know, against dense breast. And, you know, it seemed to me like if this option is available, you know, and it's available, you know, relatively quickly, so you can, you know, alleviate people's concerns, women's concerns, I think it would be a great thing to do. I mean, I didn't realize that dense breasts were, you know, 50% of the population.
I didn't either.
And, you know, we've mentioned this paper. I might just tick off some of the key top level findings. They randomized patients to the order of the exam, and everybody got both digital breast tomosynthesis, the sort of 3D mammo, if you will, and they got this abbreviated breast MR. And overall, the sensitivity for abbreviated MR was 96%.
Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot better than that 50% or whatever it was in 91 when we used to do this.
Yes, right? And the digital breast tomosynthesis sensitivity was only 39% for detection of the cancers. Now there is another side of the coin: the specificity. In other words, when they detect something, is it really cancer? For the abbreviated MR, it was 87%, which means you had some false positives in there that either got more imaging or even biopsies. So, you know, this needs to be taken into account when you're looking at large populations. The digital breast tomosynthesis was much less sensitive, but it was more specific, 97%. So when you look at the positive predictive value of the test, they're fairly similar. But when you step back and say, why are we doing this to detect cancer, the abbreviated MR was vastly superior, detecting all 17 invasive cancers, where the DBT only detected 7 in this population.
You know, one of the things, and I remember this from back in the day when we first started doing the time of flight MRA, for example, for carotids. It in and of itself is still a really good screening tool, because you may get false positives, but you don't get false negatives. In other words, if it's negative, it's negative. The false negatives on abbreviated breast MRI would be fairly low, would it not?
Yes.
Much less than mammography or even digital breast tomosynthesis, correct?
That's right.
I can't say
that
word.
Say that three times fast, Bill.
I cannot say that word. I will not say it again.
It's three DBT. Words. It's three words, Bill.
DBT. So again, back to that. So, right, I mean, the DBT has a much higher false negatives, whereas the abbreviated breast would be very low in false negatives.
That's exactly right. In other words, you're going to detect virtually all the cancers with the abbreviated MR, and really less than half in the case of digital breast tomosynthesis.
Which, you know, when you're in that range, I mean, literally that's like a coin toss, right? You know, do you have cancer or not? Flip a coin.
Exactly.
More or less. I mean, same.
So in this
statistic.
Yeah, in this setting, it looked like abbreviated MR was the clear winner. Now, we don't have 20-year follow-up to know just how good it was in determining, you know, detecting not only the invasive, but the ductal carcinoma in situ cases.
Well, as a woman, the only one on this this talk right here, I'd much rather have a false positive than a false negative.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And so I do believe that, and based upon the study, obviously it was superior doing the breast MRI versus the digital breast tomosynthesis, or DBT.
Right. Nicely said,
Chris. Much more nicely said than mine. One more thing I want to bring up. We alluded to it briefly, but before we end this MRI cast, which thank you all very much. I think it's been extremely interesting. Has to do with the use of CAD. Now, if you don't, Howard, Kristen, correct me if I'm wrong here, but if you don't do dynamics, which they didn't do in this protocol, CAD's not really utilized, or is it?
Right. I didn't see any reference to the use of CAD in the Comstock paper. It sounded like they just did pre and post gradient echoes.
Yeah, I know a lot of people really seem to put a lot of emphasis on CAD, and listening to a lot of people, you know, talk, Elizabeth Morris, and certainly Christiana Kuhl, you know, the importance of CAD is not all that high, correct? I mean, that's what I hear a lot of people say. It's like, you know, yeah, you know, we got it, we do it, but.
Well, you know, I think it's a moving target. And with all the developments in AI, augmented intelligence or artificial intelligence, DL recons, you know, and things like that, I think even for traditional images, we're going to see improvements. And we know that our eyes don't see everything. There are things like texture analysis and so forth. So I would definitely keep an open mind toward various types of computer-aided diagnosis. I think that's going to be the future, not only in breast, but in lots of other areas.
Yeah, actually, the thing I was referring to is like with the dynamic, you know, you get the curves and you get the colors, right? You know, which basically the color is, and going back to the deal with the higher relaxivity agents, I mean, we've actually talked to people and had clients that we've worked with to help them optimize protocols who say, we don't want to go to a higher relaxivity agent because we'll have to change our CAD. But that's just that's a user selectable, arbitrary.
It's a threshold change, and that's all it really is. And I've actually had a situation. I was called from someone in Texas, and they said, we were told that we cannot use a high relaxivity agent because we can't use the CAD any longer. And it really just turned out that the CAD representative had to come in and just change the thresholds. And it was a very easy fix. And I don't think people realize that because the colors look different. They think that something's inaccurate, and that's not true.
Yeah. I mean, Howard, your thoughts on that? Because that is something that if you do use that and you use a higher relaxivity agent, you really just need to cut your threshold back. It's not going to change anything. It's
right.
Just
the whole reason
it's the maximum peak.
You're giving the gadolinium is to see relaxivity effects, and seeing more is going to be better. And it's been shown in double-blind randomized crossover trials that you see more with a high relaxivity agent. And that's not only seeing more, it's detecting more cancers.
Yeah. And again, I think that's an important point to reiterate that in this paper that we are referring to specifically, which you can actually read part of it or see part of it on antmini.com. That's where I first ran across it in my daily morning news reading through. Anybody else got either of y'all two got anything you want to throw in here at the end before we get out of here?
I think Kristen should wrap us up.
Well, I'm Kristen Harrington, and I would like to wrap up this second session of our podcast and just want to thank everyone for being a part of it.
Well, Alan, thanks. How's
that?
That's a pretty good wrap, I think. Okay. I certainly can't wrap any better than that. I want to thank Kristen and Howard for joining me on the second episode of our MRI cast. Remember to subscribe to these MRI casts via the website. Ask us some questions, pose some questions, suggest future topics if you'd like. So we'll get out of here now and get back to work, I suppose. Thank you again, Kristen, Howard, and everybody listening. We'll talk to you next time on the next MRI cast.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to MRI cast. This program is made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics.